Chapter 11, From Belly to Bow. As dusk descends on Mount Gerizim, one of two peaks overlooking the west bank city of Nablus, a noisy procession makes its way from a village to an open-air enclosure on the summit. Priests and elders clad in brightly coloured robes are accompanied along the dusty track by men and boys singing and chanting, dressed head to toe in white, some wearing matching baseball caps and welly boots. Shaggy-haired, startled-looking lambs are carried on their shoulders, or half-led, half-dragged to the mountaintop amid the excited swarm of human bodies. Women are singing too, clutching children and iPhones while they follow the procession. Everyone crowds into the enclosure. Behind camera crews, security guards and a high wire fence, tourists stand on an embankment, watching and waiting. Expectation is in the air, along with the smell of burning wood carried by smoke billowing from cylindrical fire pits dug deep into the earth. As night falls, the high priest mounts a podium and takes the microphone. Addressing the crowd with age-old prayers, he switches smoothly between ancient forms of Hebrew, Aramaic, and modern Arabic. As he finishes, he raises his staff. Large knives flash into view. The lambs' throats are cut. With clapping and jumping, cheers and chants rise up, and the singing begins again. The hot blood of the lambs is smeared on the foreheads of firstborn males there and then, and on doorposts in the village later. The dead lambs are suspended from large metal frames, where they're quickly fleeced, inspected for blemishes, and disemboweled. Blood glistens on the hands and arms of the slaughterers and stains their white tunics a deep crimson. The lambs' innards are carefully burned away on a large grill over a trough of fire, while their carcasses are salted, skewered on long wooden spits, and carried to the fire pits. Head first, they're plunged into the smoky depths and sealed in with a metal grate covered with branches, damp earth, and canvas. Later, the roasted meat will be distributed to the worshippers, accompanied by unleavened bread and bitter herbs. This is Passover, Samaritan style. The Samaritans, as they're known to the outside world, are one of the oldest and longest-lived religious communities in the Middle East. They're also the smallest, measuring only about 750 members, all of whom are related by blood or marriage. Having relocated from Nablus, ancient Shechem, during the First Intifada, 1987-93, half the community now lives in the village of Lutza on Mount Gerizim, while the other half is to be found in a long-established community in Holon, now a suburb of Tel Aviv. Like their Jewish neighbours, the Samaritans worship Yahweh as the ancient God of Israel and name the biblical Jacob as their ancestor. They too keep Shabbat, circumcise their sons, gather in synagogues, celebrate Pesach, Passover, Shavuot, Yom Kippur and Sukkot, and venerate the Torah as divine teaching. But they also claim to be the true Israelites, the name by which they refer to themselves, who have endured in a land beset by repeated conflicts, conquest, displacement and occupation, to worship on the sacred mountain first chosen by the Israelites' God upon their entry into the Promised Land, long before his illegitimate temple in Jerusalem was ever built. The Samaritans believe themselves to be the direct descendants of the tribes of Levi, Ephraim, and Manasseh, countering the Jewish tradition that Ephraim and Manasseh were among the lost tribes of Israel, who were deported to Mesopotamia in the late 8th century BCE when Assyria defeated the northern kingdom of Israel and destroyed its capital, Samaria. Although tiny in number, the Samaritans can do what modern Jews cannot. They can sacrifice animals, as God commanded. It's a practice Jewish worshippers have been unable to undertake since the Roman destruction of the Jerusalem temple in 70 CE. As the only place in which mainstream Judaism has traditionally permitted the ritual offering of animals, the loss of the temple quickly rendered Jewish Pesach a sacrifice-free domestic festival, notwithstanding recent scandalous attempts by religious activists to slaughter lambs on Temple Mount. In both the Samaritan and Jewish Torah, the Pesach sacrifice is an offering to Yahweh combined with a rush ritual meal, commemorating the haste of the Israelite exodus from Egypt. The blood of the lambs daubed on the doorposts of homes served to protect the Israelite firstborns from the deadly presence of Yahweh and his supernatural envoy, the destroyer, who passed over Egypt to kill the firstborn sons of the enemy, terrifying a grief-stricken Pharaoh into allowing the Israelites to leave. Historically, however, the origins of this sacrifice are very different. As attested in most human cultures, food and drink are powerful carriers of religious experience, experiences directly related to the social function of food and drink as makers and conveyors of meaning. This meaning derives not only from the essential role of eating and drinking for our physical well-being and survival, but from the very transience of the food we eat and the liquids we drink. Of all human activities of production, the cultivation, processing, and consumption of food is perhaps the most remarkable. No other material product is created as intensively for the precise purpose of being destroyed. This renders food and drink inherently suited to playing a role in rituals expressing both a community's cultural values and its social relationships, including its ties to any ancestors, gods, or spirits who might shape its world. When a community eats together, group identities are fed and nourished by food and drink. Against this backdrop, the sacrificial offering of domestic animals is an especially powerful ritual act. In Samaritanism, Judaism, and Christianity, the Passover meal is the central act of an ancient scriptural story articulating a distinctive community identity. But at its heart is a much older agricultural celebration of firstborn animals, in which a community's deities were given their portion of the flocks and herds they had rendered fertile. In a pastoral agrarian economy, in which ordinary families depended on domesticated animals primarily for their wool, hides, milk, dung, and traction power, the slaughter of a young animal for meat was infrequent enough as to be rendered sacred. Accordingly, meat was a delicacy for most people and was naturally to be shared with the gods who sustained the flocks and herds. Eating together, worshippers and gods were bound together socially, creating and maintaining ties forged on reciprocal hospitality. The close interrelation of agricultural productivity and divine consumption was written into the earliest Southwest Asian stories about the origins of mortals. Humans were created in order to feed the gods, not only with meat, but with the other foodstuffs they and their worshippers also enjoyed eating, including bread, fruit, grain, oil, honey, beer, and wine. Provisioning the gods with their daily meals was not to suggest divine weakness or dependency. After all, deities were perfectly capable of feeding themselves. Myths often describe them preparing and sharing meals of bread and wine, sacrificing and eating animals, holding ceremonial feasts, and throwing drinking parties, all of which bound them together as an extended heavenly household. But the mortal duty to feed the gods was considered essential to the flourishing of cosmic order. One of the oldest narratives describing this ordered cosmos is crafted not in words, but in images and symbols. The meter-high Uruk vase was made for the Sumerian goddess Inanna in about 3100 BCE. It was smashed during the looting of the National Museum in Baghdad at the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003, but has since been returned and restored. This stunning alabaster vessel presents a coherent portrait of the inextricable bonds between agricultural fertility, human endeavour, and the worship of the gods. Circling its lowest register are fertile waters from which ordered rows of barley spring. Above them, male and female sheep and goats file dutifully around the vase. In the middle register, the fruits of agricultural plenty are borne aloft in baskets and jugs by nude male priests in a ritual procession. Their destination is depicted on the top register, where an elite female, either the goddess or her human representative, stands in Inanna's temple, surrounded by goats, jugs, and baskets overflowing with food. In Sumerian mythology, The job of feeding the gods was a role initially performed by lower-tier deities, who were tasked with baking bread for the high gods, filling their table with food, and digging out canals to irrigate fields and transport their crops. When the high god Enki is told that they are complaining about their life, smashing up their tools and blaming him for their miserable fate, he devises a way to call a halt to the unrest. He engages the mother goddess Namu and her assistant birth goddesses to shape new life from wet clay. Mortals are made, and the burden of feeding the gods is imposed on them. A similar innovation to alleviate the divine workload is attributed to the god Marduk in the Babylonian epic Enumer-Lish. I shall compact blood, I shall cause bones to be, I shall make stand a human being, let man be its name, he declares. I shall create humankind, they shall bear the god's burden that those may rest. But to be a creature of the gods and to take on their labour was to be regarded as a cosmic privilege. The primal human was a prototype of the king, divinely appointed to shepherd the rest of humanity and ensure the gods were brought food offerings. In the temple cults of Mesopotamia, the king was accordingly known as the gardener of the gods. He oversaw the purity of temples, the fullness of their animal pens, grain silos, oil presses, and wine stores, and richly tended to the sacred trees within their precincts. Echoes of this mortal and royal privilege can be detected in the myths of human and agricultural origins in the Bible. Like his older divine colleagues across Mesopotamia, Yahweh was well able to cultivate land and grow food himself. And according to Genesis 2, this is exactly what he did. When there was no man to till the soil, Yahweh planted a garden in Eden, created waterways to irrigate it, and made to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, including the two trees set apart for him, which stood at its centre. But the upkeep of the garden was not work with which God needed to occupy himself every day. After all, this was a deity who would elsewhere declare that he liked a day's rest at the end of a busy week. And so the first man is created from clay for a very specific purpose. Yahweh God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to care for it. Like a king, the primal man is appointed the gardener of God. Although Yahweh is not said to receive sacrifices in Eden, the divine expectation for food is quickly met by Eve's first sons, Cain and Abel, in Genesis 4. Abel is described as a keeper of sheep, and Cain as a tiller of the ground, and they each offer Yahweh a portion of their produce. Abel's lambs are favourably received, but Cain's crops are rejected. His culinary faux pas triggers his second, more infamous crime, the murder of his brother, whose blood screams out to God as it seeps into the ground and down into the underworld. Like Adam, Cain is sent away from Yahweh's presence and away from the soil he tills to scratch an existence from the uncultivated, unyielding dust at the ends of the earth. Readers often suppose a theological preference for blood sacrifice underlies God's distaste for Cain's meat-free option. But this is to misunderstand the cultural climate in which these myths were cultivated and betrays a common misunderstanding of sacrifice only as ritual killing. Across ancient Southwest Asia, most foodstuffs consumed by humans were potential sacrificial offerings, whether animal, cereal, vegetable, fruit, or liquid. But the apportioning of the sacrifice was crucial. God looks with displeasure upon Cain's offering, not because crops were inherently inferior to livestock as sacrifices, but because Cain neglects to offer the distinctively sacred portion conventionally set apart for divine consumption, the first fruits of the harvest. He sacrifices what is described only as the fruit of the ground. By contrast, Abel sacrifices the cream of his crop, the firstlings of his flock, their fatty parts. As the first to open the womb, these animals were of the highest cultural and religious value, and so naturally belonged to Yahweh. The pieces he particularly liked were their fatty parts, the succulent slipperiness coating the intestines, kidneys, and liver, plus the spongy thickness of the lamb's tail. Yahweh's preference for particular portions was not only a matter of divine taste, but a mark of godly distinction. Like other rituals, sacrifice was far from a symbolic gesture. It was a loaded, magical performance in which imagined realities about the world were brought into being, enacted, and endorsed by all its participants, the gods included. Setting apart, rendering sacred, certain portions for the deity drew an important distinction between a god and a mortal. Both ate, and in the cult place they ate together, but the exclusive allocation of the firstborn, firstfruits, and fatty parts to the deity drew on the essential primacy of food to materialize and mark the fundamental difference between gods and mortals, the difference between who was a god and who was not. To consume sacred food without divine permission, like Adam and Eve, or to serve the wrong portion of food, like Cain, was to neglect this carefully constructed distinction and throw the world into disarray by dishonoring the divine. It had long been known that the way to any deity's changeable heart, or mind, was through their stomach. As one Hittite priest put it in the 13th century BCE, "Is the mind of man and those of the gods somehow different? No, the mind is indeed one and the same. The priest gives his master something to eat, or he gives him something to drink. And since he, his master, eats and drinks, he is of a tranquil state, and he is therefore attached to him." Like mortals, the gods took great sensory pleasure in eating and drinking. In addition to quenching their thirsts and filling their bellies, deities enjoyed the taste and texture of good food and drink. Sacrificial meat is frequently praised as succulent and tender. Sacred wine is sweet, spiced, or smooth. Bread and grain is pleasingly salted. But it was the smell of roasting flesh and the fragrant seasoning of incense that whetted divine appetites, drawing the gods to the altar and into a social relationship with the worshipper. A mythic precedent for this was to be found in the great flood stories circulating ancient Southwest Asia, in which the broken bond between the gods and humanity was restored after the deluge by a sacrifice of ark animals offered by the flood hero. In a Mesopotamian version, dated to the 18th century BCE, the fabled Atrahasis is cast in the lead role. His offering proves irresistible to the gods, who smell the fragrance and gather like flies around the sacrifice before sitting down to eat with him. A later version in the Epic of Gilgamesh names the hero as Utnapishtim, who adds aromatic incense to his post-diluvial sacrifice. Again, the gods gather like flies, but this time they swarm about the one who had made the sacrifice, emphasizing the social function of the feast. A millennium or so later, in the Book of Genesis, it is Noah who emerges from the ark to offer a grateful sacrifice. The smoky scent of animal sacrifice not only draws God to Noah's newly built altar, but triggers his change of heart towards all mortal creatures. When Yahweh smelled the pleasing odour, Yahweh said in his heart, "I will never again curse the ground because of humankind, nor will I ever again destroy every living creature." The sensory pleasures of sacrifice bring the deity into a binding relationship with all life in the earthly realm. Divine dining. It's no surprise to find that meat heavily flavours most biblical accounts of sacrifices offered to Yahweh. In the Jerusalem temple, the altar was sprinkled and smeared with the blood of sacrificial animals, cleansing Yahweh's dining table before he ate, while the pleasing odour of their roasting flesh alerted the busy deity to mealtimes. Pork, of course, was off the menu, not because it harboured potentially deadly bacteria, as is often supposed, but because the pig tended to be regarded as a dangerously liminal animal. With the feet of a cud eater, the diet of a scavenger, the habits of a dirt dweller, and the cunning of a human, it exhibited an unsettling combination of characteristics, rendering it culturally inedible for some, but not all, southern Levantine peoples, for whom pigs were often associated with the underworld or malevolent supernatural powers. But there was plenty of other meat for Yahweh to enjoy. Twice a day, he consumed at least one roast lamb or goat, along with braised birds, breads and cakes, seasonal fruit and grain, flour mixed with oil, and several jugs of wine and beer. Additional snacks, a bird, a basket of fruit, bread or a cake, were brought to the temple by worshippers who might be offering thanks to the deity or hoping for a special blessing or seeking divine forgiveness. Once a week on Shabbat, Yahweh's daily portions were doubled and supplemented with 12 loaves of bread, which were served on a special offering table, dressed with a tablecloth, a 7-branched candelabra, and fine dinnerware. Special occasions, monthly feast days, and annual festivals offered the deity a welcome opportunity to binge. On the new moon, Yahweh ate 2 roast bulls, a ram, and 7 lambs, plus the usual trimmings of flour, oil, and wine, with a goat for afters. During the week-long harvest festival of Sukkot, the deity consumed a total of 71 bulls, 15 rams, 105 lambs, and a goat. A yearly festival commemorating the construction of the Jerusalem Temple is said to have included Yahweh and his worshippers gorging themselves on 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep in a fortnight. Within the religious imagination, the excessive nature of divine dining reflected the enormous size of God's body, so that his huge appetite matched his gigantic frame. In practice, however, the ritual menus of the Jerusalem temple were far more modest than the biblical writers would allow. After all, the sheer scale and expense demanded of some biblical sacrifices and the logistics of managing such copious volumes of blood, flesh, dung and bones would have been wildly impractical and wholly improbable. But behind the Bible's sacrificial texts were elitist urban writers who were naturally regurgitating the ideological tastes of their social circles, in which conspicuous consumption and its associated rhetoric played a crucial role in the theatre of religious, economic, and political performance. Whether big or small, the spectacle of sacrifice and feasting with the patron deities of cities and states communicated the status, power, wealth and provision on which all ancient Southwest Asian kings and priesthoods relied. Onto this temple-centric view of the world, religious specialists mapped a spatial framework of an ordered cosmos. The temple altar not only served as the dining table around which God and favoured mortals shared food, but it was the centrepiece of the ordered built environment managed by city-dwelling elites. Surrounding the urban centre were the fertile, cultivated soils of the villages and farmsteads that fed the deity and his worshippers in the city. At the edges of the fertile world were the dry expanses of the unworked, dangerous wilderness, and beyond that were the raging waters of disruptive disorder. All members of society, mortal and divine, were placed within this framework, from its privileged centre to its dreaded margins. Firmly fixed at the core of the cosmos, temple sacrifice fed not only the deity, but the political appetites of elites. The God of the Bible was well aware of the ideological dynamics of sacrifice and quick to chastise those making offerings for the sake of their own reputations rather than his. "What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices?" bellows an exasperated Yahweh in the book of Isaiah. "I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or lambs or goats. Trample my temple courts no more." He goes even further in the book of Amos. "I hate, I despise your festivals. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. The well-being offerings of your fatted animals I will not look upon." These oracles, dated to about the 8th century BCE, would eventually come to fuel an unpleasant Christian history of anti-ritual rhetoric, attacking first the superstitious practices of Judaism and later, for Protestants, the idolatry of traditional Roman Catholicism. But in their ancient biblical contexts, the divine rejection of sacrifice in these and similar oracles was not a wholesale rejection of food offerings. It was a pointed critique of wealthy urbanites whose self-centered, grandiose sacrifices had become empty gestures, fueled by the economic exploitation of the poor and the marginalized, on whose backs they had built their fortunes. Learn to do good, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow, Yahweh continues in the book of Isaiah. You trample on the poor and take from them levies of grain. Seek good and not evil, he similarly cries in the book of Amos. The divine rejection of sacrifices was an age-old threat across ancient Southwest Asia. Deities might decide to fast in mournful response to catastrophe, or they might punish religious and social transgressions by withdrawing from their worshippers. Withdrawal meant social dislocation. The gods abandoned their statues and temples, leaving their food unsmelled and untouched. Sometimes the rejection of a sacrifice was clear to see. A burnt offering refusing to flame, a loaf falling from a plate, spoiled fruit, spilled beer, or wine swimming with sediment. But more esoteric skills were required to spot the signs invisible to the untrained eye, for divine consumption was an inherently and inevitably ambiguous process. Although all sacrificial food was offered to the gods, they ate only their portion. The deity's leftovers were divided between the priests, the sacrificial donor, and the donor's household, who ate their share in the ordinary way in which humans do. But gods, of course, ate their sacrificial portions differently. Burning on the altar, their portion of fatty meat, oil, flour, or grain was engulfed by the radiance emanating from the divine body and devoured by its fiery force. As the flaming food was transformed into scented smoke, it was further consumed by the gods as they inhaled its fragrant new form. Divine food was less toasted and roasted than torched, scorched, and burnt to a crisp. But this was a process complicated by its more unpredictable aspects, the changing direction of the smoke's progress, the precise moment at which incinerated food remains collapsed on the altar, the length of time it took an offering to turn to ash. It thus fell to priests and seers to discern the difference between a rejected sacrifice and the mysterious mechanics of divine consumption. Sharing the gods' meals in the cult place better enabled some religious specialists to perceive this information. As they're ingested, food and drink become embodied materials. Within religious contexts, this embodiment lends ritual comestibles a heightened significance and power. Swallowing sacred substances temporarily transforms the body by incorporating something of the divine or holy within it. It's a notion on which the Christian consumption of sanctified bread and wine rests, whether the ritual is taken to be a transubstantiation, substitution, or commemoration of the body and blood of Christ, which is itself a practice echoing something of the ingestion of sacred food in Yahweh's temple in Jerusalem. Here, the holiness of the deity's priest was not only maintained by an adherence to ritual distinctions between the sacred and the profane, but by the regular consumption of the gods' food and drink. In the books of Exodus and Leviticus, sacrificial meat is to be eaten and enjoyed by priests because whatever touches its flesh shall become holy. Mortal holiness was not simply a social status, but a somatic state of being, enhancing or transforming the priest's religious perceptions. The same was true of other religious specialists, for whom the ingestion of divine matter functioned as oracular food, triggering visions and utterances. In the book of Jeremiah, the prophet's career as a diviner of visions begins when he eats the words or things Yahweh places in his mouth, while the prophet Ezekiel eats a honeyed scroll of oracles given to him by God so as to regurgitate its words to the people. Even in the hands of hated enemies, the contagious, oracular potency of sacred food clung to Yahweh's dinnerware. In the book of Daniel, Belshazzar of Babylon drinks from the vessels looted by King Nebuchadnezzar from the Jerusalem temple and experiences a vision of doom when he suddenly sees a heavenly hand writing words of destruction on the palace wall. The transformative power of sacred food and drink enabled priests, prophets, and other ritual specialists to perceive otherworldly realities more clearly. Visions were seen, oracles were communicated, and divine decisions were revealed. Sacred alcohol was an especially effective agent of divination. Its psychoactive properties enhanced religious perception, freeing the body from the constraints of mortal control to be taken over by divine powers. The gods themselves were familiar with the ways in which beer and wine offered access to alternative realities, for they used alcohol as a means of transforming or transgressing their own cosmic rules of order to which they more usually adhered. A Sumerian myth tells of a drunken competition between the wise god Enki and the lofty lady Ninma, the top birth goddess of the pantheon. Celebrating the creation of the first mortal, the two deities drink beer to the point of intoxicated elation, prompting Ninma to boast that she has the power to decide the fate of humans, good or bad, because it is she who shapes the mortal form. In response, Enki wagers that no matter what kind of ill-fated mortal she creates, he will find it good fortune. The contest begins. Ninma pinches off clay to create a range of humans whose bodies deviate from the paradigmatic human Enki has already devised. But each time, competitive, cunning Enki finds a good place for the new life in the world. The mortal, unable to use his arms or hands, is set on his feet to stand with honour next to the king. A man deprived of sight is to be a gifted musician. The mortal who is lame in the feet becomes a skilled artisan. The man afflicted with an ever-leaking penis is healed of his sickness. The woman unable to give birth is given a career in the royal household. The human with neither male nor female sex organs is appointed chief courtier to the king. Enki then plays his winning hand. He creates a human form so helpless, its fate can only remain uncertain. It's a newborn baby. If divine drunkenness enabled the gods to bring diversity and uncertainty to the human world, it also empowered them to turn their own world temporarily upside down by experiencing alternative states of being. In a fantastically vivid myth detailed on a clay tablet from 14th century BCE Ugarit, the high deity Ael hosts a lavish feast for his pantheon in his temple. "Eat, O gods, and drink! Drink wine until satiety, foaming wine until intoxication," he commands. The dinner guests appear to do precisely this, and disorder ensues. The moon god Yeri, normally responsible for calendrical ritual order, refills his wine goblet and drags it under the dinner table like a dog, where the goddesses Anat and Athtart gleefully treat him as such by throwing him choice cuts of sacrificial meat, much to the disapproval of the divine bouncer on the door, who yells at the goddesses and then at Ael himself. But the party isn't over. Ael gathers his drinking companions and they move on to the next venue, an exclusive drinking club known as the Marzeach, of which Ael was divine patron. There, it is said, he drank wine to satiety, new wine until intoxication. It's time to go home. But as he stumbles off towards his dwelling, supported on either side by the junior deities Thukamun and Shannin, he is suddenly approached by a creeping monster who has two horns and a tail. Scholars are uncertain as to the identity of this monster, but it's likely some sort of scorpion deity charged with guarding the portal to the dangerous netherworld. It's into this other world that Ael passes, for the encounter prompts Ael to transgress taboos around divine contact with muck and filth as he loses complete control of his body. He floundered in his own feces and urine, Ael fell down like a corpse. Ael was like those who go down into the underworld. To the modern eye, this might read like a slop scene from a bawdy pantomime, but this is the language of myth. Dead drunk, Ael descends to the underworld, a realm constructed in such stark opposition to the heavenly plane that only the sun deity was permitted to pass through it safely each night. But in his intoxicated state, Ael undergoes a bodily transformation so intense he experiences an alternate reality. He transcends the boundary between the heavenly and netherworldly realms, his bodily excretions cloaking him with a protective disguise as he enters a dank world of mud and muck. His return from this state appears to have been facilitated by the earliest known use of the hair of the dog to cure a hangover, although its ingredients differ from the alcoholic versions with which we're more familiar today. Inscribed on the same clay tablet, the recipe calls for the hair of a dog and the knot of a vine shoot to be blended in virgin olive oil and then rubbed on the patient's forehead. Ael's cured and awakens. Sobriety and order are restored. Like his divine predecessor at Ugarit, the god of the Bible was well acquainted with the private drinking club known as the Marzeach, for his own high-status worshippers were said to be its members. According to the Book of Amos, these members are the wealthy urbanites of late 8th century BCE Samaria, who drink wine from bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils. Later, in the Book of Jeremiah, they are the citizens of 6th century BCE Jerusalem, who share ritual meals with their deified ancestors in the underworld. But not everyone approved of the use of alcoholic intoxication as a means of accessing otherworldly knowledge. The priest and the prophet reel with strong drink, an appalled seer declared at about the same time. They are confused with wine, they stagger with strong drink. This loss of bodily control brings not divine revelation, he claims, but distorted religious perception. They err in vision, they stumble in giving judgment. Worse still, their excessive drunkenness rendered the cult places in which they worked dangerously impure. All tables are covered with vomit and excrement, no sacred place is clean. As far as this seer was concerned, it was just one of many cultic corruptions to bring disaster upon Jerusalem in the 6th century BCE in the form of military invasion and destruction, orchestrated by God himself. It was a view shared by other divinely inspired critics of the city's temple cult, whose visions would find their way into the texts of the Hebrew Bible. Yahweh no longer tolerated ritual intoxication among his temple personnel, they claimed. Instead, the divinatory wine he once shared with his elite worshippers would become a toxic cup of wrath, poisoning the temple community from the inside, leaving them unable to maintain the sanctity of God's house and unfit to defend against bullying empires. Drink, get drunk and vomit, fall but rise no more, because of the sword I'm sending you, Yahweh declares. The cup would remain a stock feature of God's ritual arsenal of divine judgment, ever in hand, ready to be passed to those in the earthly realm as he saw fit. It's the cup he forces on his battered wife in the Book of Ezekiel, commanding her to drink deep of shame. It's the cup he gives to the kings of enemy nations, forcing its scorching liquid down their throats. And in a place called Gethsemane, it's the cup a frightened Jesus of Nazareth begs God to remove as the darkness of night moves towards the day of his death. Divine dirt. Sacred wine was not the only feature of ritual consumption to be weaponized by the God of the Bible. Sacrificial animals themselves would also be used against his own people. By the beginning of the 5th century BCE, the Jerusalem temple had been rebuilt. Yahweh had returned, his priesthood had been restored, and divine dining in the sacred heart of the city had resumed. According to the Book of Malachi, however, the new temple was beset with sacrificial irregularities, and Yahweh was furious. "You have offered polluted food on my altar," he bellows at his priests. "You bring what has been taken by violence or is lame or sick, and this you bring as your offering? Shall I accept that from your hand? Cursed be the cheat who has a male in the flock and vows to give it, and yet sacrifices to the Lord what is blemished." Like any other economic establishment, a temple was not immune to corner-cutting and corruption. But the sacrifice of limping, mange-ridden animals was beyond unethical. It was physically repellent to Yahweh, triggering disgust so visceral that he would do unto others as was done unto him. "I will smear shit on your faces, the shit of your festal animals." As far as Yahweh was concerned, blemished animals were not food at all, but the antimatter of consumption, equivalent to the stinking, inedible feces expelled by the body. If his priests put this filth in his face, he would thrust shit into theirs. God's earthy language, more usually sanitized as dung or dirt in translations, reflects the depth of his disgust and the foul physicality of his attack. It is a gut response to an inedible meal. And his decision to weaponize the dung of sacrificial animals underscores this. Whether dropped from their bodies or scooped from their butchered innards, the excrement of sacred animals was of a special status. Its association with the temple demanded its careful desacralization by means of ritual burning at a site in Jerusalem's Hinnom Valley, just beyond the city's inevitably named Dung Gate. Like any other form of excrement, the feces of sacrificial animals were not inherently defiling. Some biblical texts instruct priests to burn the dung of sacrificed bulls and cows as an offering, while in the everyday world, feces of various forms, including human, were commonly used as a fertilizer and fuel. Even the dung beetle, complete with a ball of excrement between its claws, had been a sacred solar emblem of the Kingdom of Judah since at least the 8th century BCE. But excrement of any sort might trigger social and ritual anxieties if it was out of place, as the anthropologist Mary Douglas famously put it. It's God's deliberate displacement of feces that renders his attack on his cult officials so shocking in its ancient cultural context. He transforms sacrificial scat into a priestly pollutant, forcing his priests' removal from the sanctuary, just like the muck with which they are covered. Contrary to common perceptions about biblical constructs of the divine, Yahweh of Jerusalem was not always averse to getting his hands or feet dirty. Nor was he unfamiliar with human excrement. As was usual in the Iron Age Levant, most urban households were not equipped with a privy or cesspit. People relieved themselves in alleyways and stairwells, or walked through the city to use a communal cesspit or open sewer, often located just beyond the city walls. If they were caught short at home, some sort of chamber pot would be available, the contents of which would be thrown out into the street. Either way, defecation was often a public rather than private activity, and everyone was unflappably familiar with the ever-present sight and smell of human excrement. Even so, it was to be kept out of ritual space and away from the gods, unless the gods decided otherwise. Like other deities, the God of the Bible would often exhibit seemingly transgressive social behaviours and flout his own cultic regulations, whether to discipline and horrify others, or simply to demonstrate his godly ability to bend and transcend boundaries. In the Bible, he could be found ankle-deep in feces as he tramples the Moabite enemies into a vast dung heap. He vows to dispose of the royal house of King Jeroboam I of Israel by clearing it away as he would household excrement. After a military attack on Jerusalem, he washes the excrement and blood from the traumatized, brutalized women of Zion. Given his apparent familiarity with human feces, the temple priests who ended up with a face full of filth should have counted themselves lucky that the shit God spread was merely animal excrement. A century or so earlier, in the Book of Nahum, he had deployed feces far fouler as a material and psychological weapon of warfare. Nahum may be a small text, but its three short chapters are bloated with the violence and brutality of Yahweh in his role as a divine warrior. Falsely claiming responsibility for the fall of the Assyrian city of Nineveh in 612 BCE, the deity describes his assault on it as a sexual attack on a woman, likely a thinly disguised manifestation of the goddess Ishtar, the city's powerful patron. Wrenching her skirts over her head, he displays her genitalia to onlooking nations and says, "I will throw shit all over you and disfigure you and make you a spectacle." Combined with graphic corporeal imagery, the excremental language he uses strongly suggests that this is not animal dung. In behaving in this way, God was mimicking some of the more concrete ways in which human aggressors sought to disempower other people's deities and their urban centres. According to the books of Kings, when King Jehu of Israel came to power, he not only tore down the Temple of Baal in the city of Samaria, but permanently desecrated its holy ground by turning it into a public dung heap. It's a biblical story with an astonishing archaeological parallel. In 2016, the Israel Antiquities Authority announced an extraordinary discovery at late 8th century BCE Lachish, one of the most important cities in the ancient kingdom of Judah, besieged and destroyed by the Assyrians in about 701 BCE. A shrine had been found inside the city's six-chambered gateway, which served, like other city gates, as a ritual space in which political, judicial, and civic matters were managed under the watchful eyes of the gods. Two large stone altars in the shrine had been desacralized, while in its holiest heart, a toilet seat had been installed. It was a large block of stone, a sizable hole cut through its center and bisected at the front by a deep aperture well-suited for a dangling, urinating penis. Chemical tests suggest that neither the toilet seat nor the ground around it had been used for urination or defecation. This was a magical installation manifesting the deliberate desecration of the shrine. The toilet not only invited impurity into its sacred space, but effectively replaced its altars, the gods' own dining tables. It might as well have been daubed with the slogan, "Eat shit." This was a high-status desecration. Only the more affluent or powerful of elites enjoyed the luxuries of a privy, a cesspit or basin topped by a wooden frame or a bore-holed stone seat in a small room or enclosure. Lachish's gate shrine had been decommissioned at the command of someone with the wealth, authority, and audacity to displace the city's gods, among whom was a local version of Yahweh himself. The likely culprit is a king, either Sennacherib of Assyria, who destroyed the city shortly afterwards, or Jerusalem's own Hezekiah, as the shrine's excavators propose, who is thought to have imposed a short-lived economic measure during the Assyrian invasion to divert religious revenues to Jerusalem by closing competing sanctuaries in his kingdom. The defiling power of human excrement turned not only on ritual concerns about the purity of sacred space, but emotional responses to feces. In many cultures, including our own and those of Yahweh's ancient worshippers, what is most abject is simultaneously what is and is not the stuff of self. Our own feces, vomit, urine, and blood can manifest this abjection in the most corporeal and sensory of ways, so that in their excreted state, they can trigger disgust, in spite and because of the fact that they are and are not a part of us. Indeed, in the book of Ezekiel, it's this visceral disgust that the God of the Bible exhibits when he casts his own disobedient worshippers as shit, from whom he distances himself by expelling them from his temple and territory, much as the Promised Land had done when it vomited up its abhorrent indigenous inhabitants to make room for the incoming Israelites. While the biblical writers stop short at depicting their God as a defecating deity, It was far from an alien idea. These ancient thinkers were accustomed to drawing on scatology for their theology. Usually, however, it took the form of toilet humour as a means of mocking religious opponents. It's a tactic employed in a story in the Books of Kings about the legendary prophet Elijah, who stages a competition between Yahweh and Baal in a time of drought to decide which deity is to be petitioned for fertile rains. He invites all 450 prophets of Baal to the altar on top of Mount Carmel, where each deity is to be offered a bull, the high-status sacrificial animal beloved to both. The deity whose lightning ignites the pyre is to be declared the winner. Baal's prophets prepare the bull, arrange its butcher parts on the altar, and from morning to midday cry out, "Oh, Baal, answer us!" But the god is absent, and his thunder stays silent. "Shout in a loud voice! After all, he's a god," Elijah taunts. "Maybe he's on a journey, or he's asleep and must be awakened." Or perhaps, the prophet suggests, Baal is answering a different sort of call. "Maybe he's defecating." For Elijah, Baal is a hapless god, too busy straining at stool to attend to the needs of his worshippers. By contrast, Yahweh instantly responds to Elijah's offering. Fire falls from the heavens, consuming the sacrifice, the wood and stones of the altar, and the ashes. It even licks up the water with which Elijah had confidently drenched the cult place. A downpour swiftly follows, breaking the drought. Yahweh has won. By the end of the 6th century BCE, Yahweh of Jerusalem had apparently decided he could no longer tolerate other deities. His scribes intensified their excremental excoriation of his divine competitors, moving from scatological attacks to full-on fecal defamation. The smears stain biblical texts of this period. Deities other than Yahweh become known as Gilulim, shit gods. This deliberately derogatory designation is usually rendered idols in English from the Greek Bible's idola, but its more accurate translation reflects its derivation from a Hebrew term for excrement. The Bible's shit gods are repeatedly described as man-made abominations. They are merely material lumps, whether of wood, metal, or stone. They're not responsive divine beings, but inanimate objects. Their materiality condemns them. They are reduced in name and essence to the basest form of matter, so that shit gods are rendered the waste of this world, rather than the holy host of heaven. Scholars often suppose this intense attack on cult statues in the 6th and 5th centuries BCE reflects a rejection of the traditional theology of divine bodies in favour of an increasingly immaterial, body-free god. But this was not the case. Shit gods and other divine statues were inferior to Yahweh not because they had bodies, but because they were dysfunctional and disabled. They were other gods made by human hands, objects of wood and stone that neither see, nor hear, nor eat, nor smell. Unlike the able-bodied, responsive god of the Bible, who had seeing eyes, hearing ears, a consuming mouth, and an inhaling nose. But shit sticks, and the association of feces with the ungodly or unholy would become ever more pervasive among some religious literati, who spent much of their time reflecting and expanding upon the traditions of the Torah and the prophets. By the 1st century CE, a Palestinian Jewish group known as the Essenes was said to be so stringent in honouring God's sacred time that they would avoid defecating on Shabbat. Any other day of the week, they would take themselves off to an isolated spot and carefully wrap their behinds in a garment while defecating so that they may not affront the divine rays of light of God's sight. In the scrolls of the sect living near the western shore of the Dead Sea, the idealized city of God was portrayed as a place in which human defecation would be prohibited. Citizens would have to walk at least 2,000 cubits, or just over a kilometre, to desert cesspits housed in purpose-built roofed enclosures. These attitudes were considered extreme by other Jewish groups for whom defecation was unproblematic unless it directly risked soiling sacred space or diminishing ritual activities. Accordingly, it was later said that below the courtyard of the Jerusalem temple, there was a private toilet screened by a door for the benefit of the priests, along with a mikveh for ritual cleansing should they experience a nocturnal emission while on night duty. Even outside sacred space, the pious carefully regulated their toilet habits. Early rabbinic debates about a peculiar biblical verse gave rise to a series of regulations in antiquity about the correct deportment for excretion. In Ezekiel 8, verse 16, God had complained about idolatrous worshippers facing away from him as they bowed down to the rising sun outside his temple in Jerusalem, raising their buttocks towards his house. God did not want to see backsides, whether closed or exposed, the rabbis decided. Consequently, good Jews across and beyond Palestine were encouraged to orient their bodies in spatial relation to the Jerusalem temple when urinating or defecating, even though the building itself had been destroyed back in 70 CE. Assuming, of course, male anatomy, rabbis decreed that people were to turn their backs to the direction of the temple when urinating, shielding God from their penises, and face the direction of the temple when defecating, so as to hide their buttocks. Some rabbis also encouraged the distancing of excrement from religious activities unrelated to sacred space. Personal prayers were not to be uttered in public spaces in which urination or defecation were common, and blessings were not to be said over the perfumes and oils used to fragrance the privies of those wealthy enough to have them. As the Roman Empire neared its end, purpose-built communal public toilets and private lavatories were relatively more common in cities across Southwest Asia, but they came with certain hazards. Along with cockroaches, flies, and vermin, disruptive demons and disaffected ghosts were thought to lurk in toilets, especially at night, but warding off their dangerous presence was problematic. Many rabbis in Jewish communities across the empire commanded that the amulets and holy inscriptions ordinarily worn on the body to protect people from supernatural harm were not to be taken into privies for fear of defiling their sacred forms. Hasty pre-defecation rituals and noisy rattles might be used instead to scare off malevolent forces, but most relied on the presence of another to keep guard. One particularly nervous rabbi is said to have had a pet lamb trained to accompany him to the toilet, while another installed a small opening in the wall of his privy so that his wife could rest a comforting, protective hand on his head while he was in there. Ancient Jewish regulations about defecation were inextricably tied to theological distinctions between divinity and humanity. By the end of the first century CE, God had stopped eating with his worshippers. The Jerusalem temple had been destroyed, bringing an end to the sacrificial meals Yahweh had once enjoyed. Not that he missed or needed them, he apparently insisted. "If I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you," he had once threatened, "for the world and all that is in it is mine to eat." For those still mourning the loss of the temple and its sacrifices, it was reassuring scriptural proof that God did not miss his daily barbecues. Henceforth, it was decided that he neither desired nor ate food. And if there was no food in heaven, there was certainly no excrement. Of this, the ancient rabbis were now sure. By now, God's body was growing ever more distant and distinct from those of his worshippers, who naturally continued eating and excreting. And it was the very naturalness of defecation, early rabbis argued, that served to remind humans that they were earthly creatures akin to animals and not gods. It was a religious perspective on the human body attributed to several important teachers, including Simeon ben Azai, a Jewish sage of the 2nd century CE. "A human is beautiful and praiseworthy, and also casts out an ugly thing from his opening," he is reported to have said. "If he were to cast out from his bowels foliatum or balsam or any sort of scented oil, how much the more would he exalt himself over the created beings? For this sage, defecation was a daily, humbling reminder of the raw and stinking realities of being human, no matter the divinely appointed, privileged position humans clearly enjoyed over other animals in the created earthly order. The need to defecate also served to distinguish humans from angels, by now a common feature of the heavenly realm. There was some debate as to whether angels, like God, had no need to eat, a notion encouraged by fleeting biblical references to divine messengers refusing food while on duty, or whether, unlike God, they ate only manna or the bread of heaven, which by this point was assumed to be a supernatural foodstuff, a little like the ambrosia of Greek gods, that was entirely absorbed by the body without triggering waste matter. Either way, the rabbis decided, angels did not produce excrement and had no need to defecate. But as feces-free mediators between the heavenly and earthly realms, angels set a high bar for those privileged enough to enjoy direct interaction with God. Accordingly, there arose a series of rabbinic debates exploring the practicalities of Moses' meetings with God on Mount Sinai. Moses must have emptied his bowels before ascending to the summit to receive the Torah, it was said. He fasted for the 40 days and nights he was there to avoid soiling sacred space, it was conjectured. In these ways, Moses attained and maintained the celestially somatic sanctity necessary to meet God and carry his holy commandments down to his worshippers below. If ancient Jewish teachers found themselves musing on the toilet habits of Moses, some early Christians were agonizing over the excretory activities of Christ. According to the Gospels, Jesus had made a point of eating and drinking with his followers, both before his death and after his resurrection. But missing from these stories was any clear steer from the Saviour as to whether or not he actually digested his food and defecated. For many in the earliest centuries of the faith, it was a worrying theological lacuna in their most authoritative religious texts. After all, this was a time in which Christian leaders of all stripes were fiercely debating the question of Christ's humanity and his relationship to God. Was he a mortal, so pure he was granted divinity? Or was he an angelic being? Was he a divine being clothed in the body of a mortal? Or a human who sensed and suffered like others? Was he an offshoot of God, a second, lesser God? Or was he one and the same as God, as would eventually be doctrinally decreed? Whatever he was, the question of whether or not Christ digested and defecated was loaded with theological ramifications, for it impacted ideas about his true nature. Most agreed that Christ ate and drank. This was important proof of his fleshy mortality, which was itself essential to his salvific death. But could God as Jesus really have had an ordinary body stuffed with excrement, as the second century Christian thinker Marcion objected? Would digesting corruptible, decaying matter render Christ a shit-eating God, as the philosopher Celsus scandalously observed? For many, the idea that Christ's body might produce, contain, and excrete feces was either unbearable or nonsensical. One way around the problem, as Clement of Alexandria saw it, was to suppose that Christ's body did not process food and drink in the usual way. Instead, Clement declared, it was sustained and nourished by the Holy Spirit. Christ ate and drank only to dispel future accusations that his perfect human body was a phantasm. But this proved not to be a lasting solution to the problem of Christ's bowels. Liberating him from his digestive tract stripped him too clean of his humanity. Relatively short-lived, too, was the pious premise, echoed into the 4th century, that Christ's body was essentially and miraculously constipated. Jesus performed divinity. He ate and drank in his own way without defecating. The highly influential 2nd century theologian Valentinus is reported to have written. Such was the power of self-control in him, Valentinus continued, that the nourishment in him did not become waste, since he did not possess corruption. This was not as extraordinary a suggestion as might be imagined. Valentinus was a highly educated Roman citizen who shared the widespread scientific view that the body's four elements, fire, earth, air and water, and their related qualities, hot, cold, dry and wet, and humours, blood, black bile, yellow bile and phlegm, could be perfectly balanced by disciplined self-control to keep it ticking over, rendering food as fuel and its resultant waste almost redundant. In a world in which the complete mastery of one's own body was celebrated as a superlative form of Greco-Roman masculinity, digestive self-control was similarly attributed to other great men of the past, including Pythagoras and Epimenides. Given Jesus' exemplary and enduring self-control, Valentinus seems to have reasoned, he had no need to excrete. To the modern eye, the image of a Christ incapable of defecating is just as strange as the image of a Christ who does. This strangeness is due in part to the relative speed with which questions about Jesus' excrement quickly fossilised like coprolites. In 451 CE, an ecumenical council was convened at Chalcedon, in what is now Turkey, in yet another attempt to disentangle, once and for all, the knotty relationship between Christ's divinity and his humanity. The assembled church leaders agreed that Christ was to be confessed as perfectly human and purely divine. Anything else was heretical. But the very strangeness of a defecating deity also testifies to the success of those ancient Jewish and Christian thinkers early in the first millennium CE, who worked so hard to distance the divine from the dirty. The Jewish God abandoned his muck-raking, scat-slinging activities in favour of a cleaner, purified presence, with or without a temple, while Christ, the man-God, was delicately shrouded in a cloud of incarnational doctrine transcending probing questions. Ultimately, the divine body was sanitised of the controversies wrought by what was, after all, a human rather than godly anxiety about the most abject, stinking stuff of selfhood.